We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. All right. The big story, I guess, is O.J. Simpson has died of cancer at 76. A while ago, we had heard that he had been ill. It looked like he had beat it. So this was kind of a surprise today. And I don't know, how do you feel about, my wife and I were talking earlier. It's like, O.J. Simpson's dead. I'm like, oh, really? Wow. I think, one of surprise more than anything. And then it's like, well, do you care? Well, of course you care because it's a human being, I guess. But considering his past and the crimes involved in the fall from grace, I'm not sure. I think mostly when you think of this day or you think of his death, rather, I'm not sure it's about honoring the man or whatever it is that he did accomplish in his life. I think it's more of where were you when all this went down? And you start thinking of the events that happened in and around all of this. You know, like I remember, and again, like this was almost 30 years ago. It was almost 30 years ago that this happened now. And it was interesting. I'm talking to Major Tom about this, and it's like this is before he was even born. So he knows of the story that came afterwards. And I guess.
Well, the glove quote as well is pretty popular, but that's about it, honestly.
If it does not, yeah. If it does not fit, you must acquit. And we all remembered this trial, and every day it was just such a, and again, this was before social media, so it was just all about TV or CNN and what have you, and every day this went on. We got to know the lawyers on both sides of this. They sort of became mini celebrities of sort, and, that's the actual trial. But even before that, I remember watching the slow motion chase, they called it, and because it was just I think it was Hal Cowling and his buddy driving him around with him in the back of the Bronco. And they discontinued the poor Bronco. It took like 25 years for it to come back. Look at that. So, I think it's one of those situations where you remember less about, the fall from grace or even the case or even unfortunately the murder of two innocent people. It's more of, it was one of those worldwide events that you remember where you were when you heard all of this or you watched all of this unfold. And I'll never forget, in 1995, being at Y95 in Hamilton and the newsroom at CHML, like the newsroom was jammed. It was filled with people as the verdict was coming down. And I mean, like, announcers, staff from all the different stations, salespeople, news people, they were all, that's when they had a lot of employees at radio stations. They were all gathered in the newsroom and everybody's like, and I remember that moment very, very vividly of us all. There must have been at least 30 people in the newsroom watching this all come down on the various TVs that they have in there. So it was, it was a fascinating time. It was a fascinating cultural phenomenon. And it also, I think, divided a lot of the world, a lot of America, because I also remember during that time and watching this with my coworkers in the newsroom that day. And like that was like 29 years ago. Oh my God, I feel old. And I remember CNN showing you different reactions to the verdict. So if you were somewhere where there was a white audience watching the verdict, they all went, what? And then if you saw an event where it was a black audience that was watching it, they're all cheering. So it was a very divisive time in America and probably the world or anywhere where that sort of pop culture kind of paved the way and was dominant. But, as far as the person, I'm not sure we're really remembering that, and many are choosing to remember the victims here of the crime that he got off of. But oddly enough, spent the rest of his life in jail, which is another thing we were talking about earlier, is that, I think one of the things that made this case so spectacular is that he got off. and but then of course lost a civil suit. And then after that, the situation in Vegas where he was involved with in an armed robbery. And then it was a result of that that he ended up spending the rest of his life behind bars. So it's kind of bizarre how all of this came about and how it came to a peak with the trial and the not guilty verdict. And then in the end, he absolutely faces the rest of his life in jail, which is very bizarre. We're going to talk about that over the course of the afternoon and just why it had the impact that it did on the general public. I mean, obviously, he was an incredibly popular guy. I mean, he was a professional athlete, Buffalo Bill, record setter, all of that. Then got into acting, commercials, and had a small stint in Hollywood. So it's interesting how it all turned around, and in the end, he ended up passing away while incarcerated. It's fascinating. We'll talk about that coming up in just a little bit. Also, the mayor of Niagara Falls is going to be joining us. We were talking about this before the eclipse. They're having a debriefing now, and the whole, declaring a state of emergency. And, I thought about that because he said, I think that kept some people away. And if you're driving with the family, hey, let's go to Niagara Falls. They've called a state of emergency. Woohoo! Back the road flares. I mean, I can see exactly what he's talking about. We'll have that discussion with him coming up in just a bit. O.J. Simpson has died of cancer at the age of 76. How do you process something like this? It's interesting talking to Tom about this off air. He wasn't even born when this happened and only knows of the story afterwards. Those of us obviously older than him remember the whole event and how it went down. Let's bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. Alyssa PR, she's here now. Alyssa, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
If the glove don't fit, you must quit.
Man, we all remember that. I'm thinking this is less about the person and more about the where were you when this happened? Where were you when the Bronco chase went on and when the verdict came down? This was quite an event when it was going on.
It's interesting when someone like this passes. Like, first of all, I think that you and I both remember O.J. Simpson, Buffalo Bill. Yeah. O.J. Simpson, amazing NFL player. O.J. Simpson running through the airport for the Avis car commercial, leaping over people and luggage and chairs. And then suddenly there was this incident. I mean, it's a word that doesn't really tell you about the gravity of the situation of, then he will forever be linked with the murder of Ron Goldman and also his wife, Nicole Brown. And, when you talk about a legacy and everything that you've done, so everything that O.J. Simpson achieved up to that is almost a footnote, Scott. And if you take a really quick look when you Google O.J. Simpson news today, what you come up to is some about his football career, mostly about the murder trial and legal troubles. Where are his kids now? Who was he married to? Who was his children? So, there a lot of the media that what I'm seeing right now is that they're trying to slice the story as many ways as they can, everywhere from who he was, what happened, what is his legacy, and where are his kids now. So it was kind of interesting to watch from a media perspective.
Hard to believe it was like 29 years ago, almost 30 years ago, this happened. Obviously, the media is way different now. There's social media now. There wasn't then. But as this transpired, like I was thinking when I was talking to my wife about this, he got off the murder charge case. Then, of course, was found guilty in a civil suit. But then it ended up spending the rest of his life in jail through the robbery conviction and such. So either way you slice it, he died in prison.
He did. And there were so many reasons. There's a lot of conspiracy theories about, whether, did he really do it? One I heard was that he was covering up for his son that may have actually done the murders, although we'll never know that. And it's sort of an interesting denouement to his career that he was in jail for stealing memorabilia of all things.
Yeah.
So it's a very unfortunate arc to a career that you never thought would go that way. And I think that when we think about O.J. Simpson, there wasn't social media, Scott, but think about it, if there was. I mean, this was the first news story that was, as I believe, 24/7 reported from a courtroom, as I recall. We knew about the lawyers. We knew who the defending, we knew who the prosecutor was. There are still movies that you can find streaming that are made up of that, you know, what went on behind the scenes in that legal trial. So it's a story that's made up of urban legend right now, but really that was sort of our first taste of getting into news 24/7. And they had a captive audience. As you recall, CNN was on every day with the O.J. Simpson trial, broadcasting live. And after they finished broadcasting live, then they had all the guests on Larry King and every other talk show that doing a recap of what people saw. And I can remember exactly where I was when the verdict came down. Yeah. I was outside a restaurant in downtown Toronto. I was listening to, and I was plugged into my phone at the time. It's probably a flip phone, actually. And I can tell you exactly where I was and where I was standing and what I thought when I heard that verdict. And I would dare to say that anybody during that time would be able to also do the same thing.
Absolutely. We were just talking about that. I also remember I was in the newsroom with a whole pile of other people, oddly enough, in Hamilton in 1995, and it was filled with everybody waiting to see this. And I remember, again, we were watching CNN, and then they showed split screens of reaction with a primarily white audience and then a primarily black audience, and how different the reactions were between the two. And you think of civil unrest, especially in the U.S. now, or and anywhere for that matter. I mean, have things changed a lot?
You know, not so much. And I think that that was maybe sort of an undercurrent. I mean, we have seen different undercurrents. I think Rodney King was before that or during that, around during that time. So we have seen undercurrents of that. But then again, remember, there was no social media. There was, even though CNN called themselves 24-hour news, nobody was really watching the news 24 hours a day at that time. Hmm. So I think that with the explosion of citizen journalism, social media, later on top of mainstream media, these things have also almost taken a life of its own. And it's interesting how one network, CNN, was able to craft the narrative of this trial, but truly they crafted a narrative, but it was truly organic. You know, there might have been commentary before and after, but what we were seeing was truly organic. It wasn't manufactured.
It was raw news. Yeah,
exactly. It was raw news at the time. And that's what also made it so riveting and so provocative, because you couldn't make this stuff up if you tried. Remember we watched the white Bronco that going along, whatever it was, the I-95. All we were doing was watching a helicopter with a camera, watching a white Bronco speed away. And we were transfixed. And we were transfixed, not just because, you know, we're watching a white Bronco, but because it was happening live, and none of us had ever really experienced that type of journalism before. So what that did was it set the tone for every sort of provocative trial and or incident that came afterwards, in the way that it was covered, in the way that it is now reported on, and in the way that it still hopes to hold their audience's attention.
Yeah, there's if you watch LA News, man, there's a helicopter chase every day, it seems. Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert, commenting on the passing of O.J. Simpson at the age of 76. Always fascinating, Alyssa. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
We talked prior to the big eclipse with the mayor of Niagara Falls, Jim Diodati. Big day planned, lots of guests expected. And then a state of emergency was called, and I'm not sure the mayor was consulted on that. And many feel, and I believe including the mayor, that this maybe had an effect on the amount of traffic and guests they had coming into Niagara Falls. And as you think about it, you're driving with the family in the car. Hey, family, let's go to Niagara Falls. They've just called a state of emergency. Grab the road flares. I mean, I can see the point. Let's bring in Jim Diodati, mayor of Niagara Falls, and here now. Jim, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm well, and thanks for having me, Scott.
So what are your comments on, first of all, let's talk about the day and what happened and your thoughts, and then we'll weigh in on the emergency.
Well, I have to say, overall, it was a huge success for Niagara Falls, especially, you know, as Canada's number one leisure destination. We got pummeled during COVID, And by and large, domestic tourism has returned, but international has really lagged behind, and it's the last to return. So this put us on the headlines in every major market in the world. We were doing interviews, and we had coverage all over the world. It was spectacular. And I really believe that the residual impact will be, this will be the beginning of the return of the international visitor, the way it used to be pre-pandemic. So I'm thankful for it. It was great. The event went on without a hitch. We had one of the great natural wonders of the world, Niagara Falls, hosting one of the great celestial events of the universe. And Mother Nature gave us drama. And then right at the right time, opened up the skies, and we all got to see it. It was spectacular. Everybody left happy, and we're thrilled. It was a big success, and we're back from the back burner to the front burner once again.
That is obviously great to hear. I remember even watching Stephen Colbert one night, late night TV, and you getting mentioned as well. But unfortunately, it was about the state of emergency. I remember chatting with you prior to this, and you said that you had not been consulted in regard to this. How did you get here? How did Niagara Falls get to this point?
Well, it's disappointing. We weren't consulted, and we found out about it just before the long weekend, the Easter long weekend. And the big question I received, and every single media that I spoke to asked the same question, what's the emergency? And of course, there wasn't an emergency. It was potentially a big crowd. And they said, don't you save those kind of declarations for actual emergencies like, you know, a tornado, a blizzard, things like that. And I said, yes. And I wished we had been consulted, because we'd have given a different point of view, because Niagara Falls was impacted more than any other city. And to unilaterally make that decision, it was really unfortunate. But once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't get it back. There's no reversing. And you're right. No responsible parent is going to bring their kids to a state of emergency location. You don't want to take a chance. You're wondering, what is the emergency? What could it be? Of course, you start speculating, and you think no responsible parent is going to find out. So people stayed home. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is.
Maybe we're interviewing the wrong person here, Jim. So have you talked to or consulted with any of these people that made this decision prior or prior to the eclipse? Have you talked to them post?
I did. I had a chat a couple days ago with the chair, and it was a good discussion. I've got a lot of respect for Chair Bradley. In this case here, I mean, I guess we've got to agree to disagree. I think it was a mistake, a miscalculation. He got some bad information, and that led to my personal view, a bad decision. So we had an exchange of information. I mean, yeah, it was still a great event. It just could have been so much greater, so much bigger. But it's funny, the silver lining to the gray cloud, although it kept people away that day, and I believe hundreds of thousands of people away, the upside to the downside is that it once again started the international media firestorm, and it got everybody talking about Niagara Falls. In the end, we pulled it off. There were absolutely no issues whatsoever. We were overprepared, no question about it. And I'd rather be overprepared than underprepared. But the silver lining is that everyone in the world was talking about Niagara Falls a lot.
So in the end, and I hate to keep dwelling on this because there are so many positive aspects to it, Jim, but was the state of emergency needed? Did the region benefit in some way from that?
Well, we definitely were hemorrhaging from it because we were absolutely overprepared. I mean, we had police, we had RCMP, OPP, Niagara Regional, Hamilton, London, we had Niagara Parks Police, ambulance, we had fire, we had drones, helicopters. We had emergency operations centers all over, extra GO trains. I mean, we had all hands on deck. It's what Niagara Falls does. We're used to handling big events. And although it was going to be a bigger crowd than we had for Nyquilenda, it's like swimming in 10 feet of water or 100 feet of water. You use the exact same skill set. So I don't think it was a good decision. I'm not being a Monday morning quarterback. I said that before the event. But again, here we are, and I hope it's a lesson for next time that something like this isn't done unilaterally. You have to consult with all those involved.
Yeah, that just seems like common sense. What about numbers? Did you get the numbers you thought you would?
No, we didn't. Nowhere near. I mean, we had a great crowd. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it was great. I know we're looking at some of our restaurants in the Fallsview area. They're up 400%, which was great. The final number, according to police, Parks Police and the Parks Commission, was over 200,000 people, which is nothing to sneeze at, but nowhere near the million mark that we were originally looking at. And it was a combination. The weather, although the day before was great, the afternoon of was great, but it wasn't perfect, but it did end up being good enough. The biggest thing, no question about it, it was the declaration of emergency because people made the decision, I don't think I want to go into an area that's under a state of emergency. And I don't blame them because I wouldn't either.
So another couple of stories that we heard prior to this, Jim, was that hotels were gouging people. And I certainly understand the supply and demand thing around hotels and airlines and all of that. But people even being called up and you know, having the reservations canceled. Did the hospitality industry learn anything from this?
Well, now, and that's another little bit of it. It's unfortunate, but the message was miscommunicated. Nobody was kicked out of their hotel reservations to make way for people paying more. What happened was, as you're probably aware, we're hosting asylum seekers in Niagara Falls. We have been for the last couple of years, thousands, in fact. And the federal government made a decision to renew contracts. They do 3-month contracts. They renewed with one of the hotels who had already taken booking for people for the eclipse. So that's why those people ended up losing their reservations. It was to make way for a rollover or a renewal of another 3-month contract with the federal government with refugees staying in Niagara Falls.
So this has nothing to do with the bigger hotels or the casinos or any of that?
No, it didn't. And it's unfortunate because, you know, once again, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, that story just got legs and it ran away. The fact is, we are hosting a number of asylum seekers, and we've been for the last couple of years. And the federal government, you know, does renewals, but they do them in 3-month segments, and they renewed with one of the hotels. And unfortunately, the story got twisted, and it made it look wrong. Yes, the pricing was higher. They call it dynamic pricing, where you go to Disney during spring break, you pay more than you would in another time of the year. Same with us. But there were a lot of rooms available at reasonable rates the day of and the whole weekend of the eclipse.
Jim Diodati with us, Mayor of Niagara Falls. Always lots of balls in the air down there. Jim, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. You too.
Boeing, the airline manufacturer, once again in the spotlight as a whistleblower, has come forward with allegations that the plane maker has cut corners in its production of the 787 Dreamliner and 777 jet, shortening the lifespan of these long-haul planes and putting them at risk of a catastrophic failure. How do we process this as the traveling public? Let's bring in Keith Mackey. Mackey International, a consultant for aviation, with us now. Keith, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Well, good afternoon, Scott. And I apologize if I have a sore throat today and I may not speak as well as I usually do.
Oh, don't you worry about that, Keith. So what are your thoughts about what we're hearing? And, you know, if you're a traveler, how do you process all this?
Well, what he's alleging is that some of the assembly was done improperly. Many times we have two sheets of flat metal. They're supposed to fasten one on top of the other. If they don't quite touch because of the design and one is lifted a little from the other, we put what we call a shim in there, an angular piece of metal that will fit between the two pieces of metal and space them properly. And it's kind of tough to get the shims in place exactly. And he's alleging that people actually jumped on them to get them to fit properly and to get the screw holes to line up. He also alleged that the people using the drills didn't clean the shavings of the drills off, and the drills bits and shavings were trapped between the pieces of metal, thus making them not flat either. So we've got some problems if these allegations are true.
Who is monitoring this? Who verifies all this?
Well, each time a procedure is accomplished, an inspector should follow along behind. And the inspector makes sure that the procedure is done in accordance with the prescribed manual and that these things haven't taken place. Apparently, the whistleblower alleged that they're under a lot of pressure to do things quickly and trying to do them quickly, corners are cut, and the emphasis is on production, get parts out as rapidly as possible, rather than having them inspected properly by engineers.
And we've talked about this in the past, Keith, the relationship between Boeing and the FIA. Is Boeing too close to the people inspecting the planes making these decisions?
Well, Boeing really should be inspecting the airplanes themselves. The FAA is effectively a police force, and they shouldn't have to deal with this on a day-by-day basis. If there is a problem, such as enunciated by the whistleblower here, then they're going to get involved. And, of course, they've been involved recently with some inspections that Boeing has done a poor job and has failed most of them. So this keeps getting a longer and longer tale about Boeing's shortcomings.
What are your thoughts on that, Keith? That, you know, I mean, obviously things happen. Nothing is perfect, but just the sheer number of accusations and in situations like this.
Well, Boeing's been going to clean it up for 3 years now. This Dave Calhoun, that's the president of Boeing, was assigned to do that job, to clean up the production work and make everything meet standards and not be rushed. Obviously, he hasn't done that. And in my opinion, he's resigned from the company, but effective at the end of the year. In my opinion, he'd be better served resigning tomorrow and letting the public know that there's going to be some major changes, for better or worse, to get this problem corrected. I don't think the present management staying in place is really serving the interests of the company.
Is this about planes that are currently being manufactured or those that are already in the air?
Well, the allegations that he makes are going back quite a time, and it would certainly affect airplanes that are already flying.
Where does this go from here?
Well, I think the first step will be the hearings, and depending on the outcome of the hearings, someone's going to have to take some action and make sure that the job isn't done the way it is presently. It's, we can't have these things take place in a production line. And, you know, building an airplane should be a relatively straightforward project. It's designed to go together a certain way, and this isn't being done. People are not following the procedures properly.
What would you say to passengers, Keith?
Well, there are thousands of Boeing airplanes flying. Yeah. And there's a Boeing, I think, takes off every 1.5 seconds. So there's so many airplanes flying, even though some of them may have some defects. And these defects he's describing would be caught likely on further inspections down the road. But if he is correct, they certainly should not exist and should have never occurred. So I don't think you have to be worried about flying a Boeing airplane, but nevertheless, we need to make sure that the job is done properly and we aren't at any risk.
Keith Mackey with us, Mackey International, Boeing in the spotlight again for the manufacturing of their planes. Keith, as always, thanks so much for the time. Much appreciated. Be well.
You're very welcome. You too.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, today's talk.
900 CHML.
Have you ever thought about being a volunteer firefighter? And especially needed over the course of the summer, as we've seen with wildfires throughout the country and such. And have you ever wondered what it takes to become one, how you go about doing this? The feds have announced that they have agreed to double the tax credit given to volunteer firefighters, which you see in a lot of the outlying communities. This tax credit comes as Canada is expected to have another hot, dry summer. One volunteer fire department in Cape Breton has already closed. This tax credit will help that from becoming a trend in other regions across the country. To talk more about this, Greg Jones, Fire Chief, Amherst, Nova Scotia, board member of the Canadian Association of Fire Chiefs, and here now. Greg, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you very much. You as well.
First, Greg, right off the top, you, your coworkers, everybody, thank you for all the incredible work that you do day in and day out with your lives on the lines just to keep us all safe. Talk about being a volunteer firefighter. Those of us in the big city may not know much about this because we have full-time services and such, but talk about the role of the volunteer firefighter.
You know, when you think of firefighting in general across our country, every citizen believes that fire service should be the same no matter what. So across our country, volunteer firefighters do exactly that. The services that you see in the bigger centers and even the rural centers all across our country, they're all the same. Volunteer firefighters devote their time to go at a moment's notice and support their community and do the exact same job no matter who they are or where they are in our country.
And how many, or give us an example of how big a footprint the volunteer service has when it comes to firefighting. I mean, again, we talk about the big cities where they have the services, but how many volunteer firefighters would there be? Any idea?
You know, from last year, the Canadian Association of Fire Chiefs did a census to find out exactly how many volunteers we had across our country. And during our last census, we had 89,000 volunteers across Canada. There's 89,000 volunteer firefighters that devote their time with very little money or anything towards it to go out and do their job. So one thing that's been great for us is to hear this announcement from the federal government to double what they're currently getting from 3,000 to 6,000. But at the end of the day, we're still asking for more. We'd like to see it closer to 10,000 and continue to maintain our volunteer firefighters we have now and grow that into the future.
So obviously they are not paid a salary. There are some benefits, I understand. How does this work then? They would just get a tax credit and a write-off for doing this.
That's right. They get a tax credit every year during their income tax. They apply for it through the federal government and in some situations, provincial governments, and that goes towards their taxes. At the end of the day, it's a small amount to pay for volunteers that go out and really, at the end of the day, do it for free. Minus this tax credit to support their community and everyone else. If we had to pay for full-time staffing instead of volunteers, we'd never be able to make it happen across our country.
And does it matter how much you've been out, how many times you've had to answer a call, or is this just a generic across the board?
You know, there's a minimum mass, a minimum of 200 hours per year. But I can tell you from volunteers I know from all across our country, that 200 hours is taken up very quickly throughout their year. They spend a lot of time out dealing with situations, and that is a small amount of time for sure.
What about training for a volunteer?
Training for volunteer firefighting is the same you would see anywhere else. We all train to the same NFPA standards. Some provinces have standards we have to meet, but a volunteer firefighter and professional firefighter, they do meet the same training requirements.
Is it? Are there problems retaining volunteers at this point? Are they hard to get?
It is hard to retain volunteers. It is hard to get volunteers in some situations. And that's why it's so important to us to continue to push to have an increase in the volunteer firefighter tax credit, to increase it with this one from $3,000 to $6,000. But it's also not just volunteer firefighters. It's also our ground search and rescue folks from across our country that volunteer their time as well. So it's truly important that we support these volunteers. It's a totally different type of volunteerism than in many other situations because these folks go out at a moment's notice and put their life on the line to support each other and their communities.
What makes a perfect candidate for this, Greg?
A perfect candidate is someone that wants to learn, wants to be part of a team environment, and wants to devote their time to their fellow Canadians to help them at their point of need no matter what.
Are there firefighters that use this to get on full time somewhere?
Yeah, the firefighters in many cases can use this to get to a full time position. It all depends on the jurisdiction. It depends on the availability of positions that are currently out there. But it varies from different parts of our country. But being a member of a volunteer fire service, I can tell you that's where I started. I'm now a career member, but I started in a volunteer component. And it gave me the ability to be part of a team, to learn new skills, to support my community by volunteering, but also gave me an opportunity to continue this on as a career as well.
Greg Jones with us, Fire Chief, Amherst, Nova Scotia, board member, Canadian Association of Fire Chiefs. The Fed's announcing that they've agreed to double the tax credit given to volunteer firefighters to retain them and get more interested. Greg, as I mentioned before, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for so much you do for all of us and your crews over the course of a year, a day, what have you. We're very much appreciative. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
900 CHML, it's Hamilton Today. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
O.J. Simpson has died at the age of 76. How do you feel about that? It was almost 30 years ago that we all watched CNN and everything else with the slow speed chase and the trial that ensued afterwards. And then, of course, the verdict. Bill Brio with his TV critic and author. He's here now. Bill, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, I'm doing fine, Scott.
So, Bill, what are your thoughts? What do you think about when you heard this news today?
Like you were just saying, I was shocked to think it's been 30 years, right? And I think it was such a turning point, and it just seems fresher than that. There's been miniseries in 2016 that recreated it all, you know, and that was 20 years after the actual thing. But it was so vivid then, and it brought it all to life. And I remember at that time, thinking, why do we need this miniseries, even though it's got John Travolta and all these people in it? Because it seemed too vivid then, but it still seems that way.
It's not so much, and let's not, I don't mean to diminish the murder here, the loss of life or any of that, but it's not so much the crime as it is the spectacle of all of this, just the attention that it drew.
It changed television. And, you know, the reason we watch all these reality shows, well, that Bronco chase, that had more people at home watching TV than COVID, you know, like it was crazy. Remember, I was working at TV Guide. That's how long ago it was. And we were all just glued to this, watching this one white Bronco on the 405, followed by 35 police cruisers, LAPD. Yeah. And it was fascinating. And it never stopped. It just an 8-month trial. The fact that it was even on TV, I mean, it just shows you how all-consuming it was. People could not look away.
And it's one of those events where people remember where they were when they saw that chase, when the verdict came down. People remember that.
Yeah, you know, it was visceral. You could hear the out the window reactions to that verdict. And it was all about the racial divide in North America. Yeah. It was absolutely started with the Rodney King beatings 4 or 5 years earlier. There was an undercurrent, a rawness. And so when the verdict came down that O.J. Simpson was acquitted, it just split between black and white lines. And people couldn't understand how the others were reacting. But it all makes sense when you look at it in context.
I remember very vividly being in the newsroom at CHML Y95 when all of this went down almost 30 years ago, and it was filled with employees. Like, everybody came from all corners of the building when we had employees, and just filled the room and watched this come down live on CNN, as you said. But then I also remember in the coverage immediately afterwards, or maybe even it was as the decision was coming down, CNN had a split screen and they had a camera with a white audience and a camera with a black audience. And when the decision came down, half the crowd screamed and yelled with joy. The other were stunned in disbelief. It was something to see that image on TV live.
And that was where, America, the split was so obvious, and it's still with us, you know, like that's what's the rawness of it.
Yeah.
It exposed it. But yeah, you're right. We couldn't not watch, and all those characters. And every night you'd have Jay Leno making Judge Ito jokes or Cato Caitlin jokes, all the late night. And this was, you know, back then you still had Larry King, and you would have King would have all these people on his show. But it really was the place where CNN took off. This sparked the emergence of all news networks.
And, you know, you talked about the people who worked on the case or characters involved in it. They all became celebrities, whether they were witnesses, whether they were lawyers from which side or the other side, including the judge. They all became their own sort of character.
Oh, yeah. Marcia, poor Marcia Clark. She went and got her hair done, and that's all was on the cover of 15 papers the next day. It just became an obsession. And just saw those phrases, you know, if the glove doesn't, if it doesn't fit, you must have quit. You know, these are phrases that are still with us. And then you would see on Seinfeld, you know, you would see the attorney there that was just a parody of Johnny Cochran doing the same kind of phrases on that show. So just became part of the culture.
Would it be different now? Because back then there was no social media. It, and as you said, it was the, it certainly set CNN off on a path. What would this be like now, do you think?
That's a great question, Scott. I don't know. I mean, it was sort of, it was broadcast television at its height, you know, that was, it's gone downhill since then. So it was back when we all watched the same thing on TV, but I think it would maybe be just as obsessive. There would just be so much going on Twitter and Instagram and everywhere else. It probably would be even more intense.
I remember, and you alluded to this, that how it was such a controversy over whether he was guilty or whether he wasn't guilty, depending upon who you would ask. And many were outraged that he got off on that murder charge. However, you know, today I was speaking with somebody and he said, you know, despite any of that, he died in jail. He spent the rest of his life in jail.
Well, pretty much, you know, because he, you know, he was the civil trial. He was found guilty and responsible and owed $33 million. They confiscated all his Heisman trophies and everything. And that's how he got caught, was literally trying to steal back his trophies. But they went with guns to get him. And so he got 9 years. He was sentenced to like 30 years to serve nine. And it's just such a fall from grace. This guy was king of the world. Even, you know, he still holds the records in the NFL. He's a Hall of Famer there, and just was, you know, it did commercial endorsements. He was sort of this wonderful symbol that you could be colorblind, and yet he ended up being the divisive factor in sort of studies of race. So it's a fascinating story.
Are we going to see this revived in some way with his passing? Are we going to see more on this, or is this just the legacy that continues?
Yeah, I don't know if there, you know, there's always talk of more movies and things. So sure, you know, it's irresistible, I guess. But I think that it's just today with his death at 76, it's just such a fall from grace. So I couldn't tell you this red hot minute, Scott, if there'll be something on Apple TV Plus in a year. I mean, but I wouldn't bet against it.
Has the time passed? I mean, I was talking to our producer about this. He wasn't even born when any of this stuff happened. He only knows of the story. He only knows of the story after the fact, which has its own legs.
We're about to see a miniseries starting tomorrow on Apple TV Plus. I mentioned on Ben Franklin, right?
Yeah.
there's a miniseries now on John Wilkes Booth who murdered Lincoln. So there's no the clock will keep ticking on this for 100 years, I think.
Yeah, there is no timeline. Bill Brio with us, TV critic and author, commenting on the passing of O.J. Simpson at the age of 76. Bill, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott.
New data in from Abacus. Abacus data showing that the Conservatives have their strongest lead to date. What about the pre-budget rollout and everything else going on? Let's bring in David Coletto, CEO of Abacus Data, and here now. David, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Well, Scott, thanks for having me on.
So, obviously, we've seen the Prime Minister on a pre-budget tour every day, another announcement. He's been doing that for the last several days into last week. Does this or that factor into this at all?
If it is, it hasn't shown up yet, because we've got the Conservatives at the largest lead we've ever tracked, 20 points nationally, 44 Conservative, 24 NDP, 17 NDP. And this survey was done after April 1st, so as the announcements started rolling out, we were in the field, and there appears to be no evidence that as of yet, if it is going to work, it's working. You know, everything that we track, from the government's approval rating to how people feel about the prime minister to how they feel about the direction of the country, all of those are either as they were or sometimes worse than just a few months ago. So we'll see. But as of yet, not anything appearing that's going to make Liberals feel better about where things are.
Do you see that changing in the next week as we get to April 16th, or has it got to the point where people have just made their minds up and they're tuned out?
I think it's going to be really tough. And there's two reasons. One is, to your point, there is a deep level of a fatigue, I think, with Justin Trudeau himself. The desire for change is pretty broad and deep across the country. But interestingly, in this survey, we asked people whether they were aware that the government had announced back on April 1st the national school food program. And only 45% of Canadians said they were aware of it. And I think sometimes people overreport that. So more than half the country likely didn't even know about that significant announcement. And that's telling me that, you know, even if they're out there with a flurry of announcements on housing, on affordability, the two things that most Canadians say are top of mind, it's not trickling down and getting down to people. That could change if more and more people have conversations about it. But what's more interesting in that research we did is, you know, most people think that policy, for example, the national school food policy, is a good idea, but it hasn't changed their views of the prime minister or whether they would vote for the Liberals or not. And so I think the fundamental problem is not that, you know, people don't think the government's spending enough or that they aren't necessarily focused. It's simply, I think people have tuned out what he's saying. And that becomes the real problem here for Mr. Trudeau and for his government.
I heard some chatter in the last day or so. This really isn't about Pierre Poilievre. It's not necessarily about him. It's that they don't want Justin Trudeau. It's not that they like one. It's that they dislike the other.
I think that's the biggest driver in this. But let's not take away any credit to Mr. Poilievre. He is the most popular leader in the country right now. 39% of Canadians have a positive view. Compare that to 26% who say that about the prime minister. So that's a big gap. And he's not loved, and it's not Poilievre mania at the moment. But in the absence of people feeling good about the current government and them wanting change, I think the Conservatives and Mr. Poilievre have done a good job with those people looking for change to say, look, we don't have detailed policy yet, no election around the corner, but we would do things very differently and take a very different approach. And sometimes change just swamps everything else.
Do you think the inquiry into foreign interference is playing into this at all?
Frankly, not really. It's an issue that when we ask people what's on top of their mind, like 2-3% say it's in their top three issues. Mm-hmm. Not to say it's not important and that conversation doesn't matter to people, but I don't think it's registering as much as people's concerns about, you know, paying the rent or their mortgage or anything else like that. So we'll see if some other, like if some bombshells come out, that might affect how people view it. But right now, I don't think anything that comes out of this inquiry is going to make the government look good. And so anything that does is probably hurting them even more.
You said, Conservatives up 3. So they're continuing on. Liberals showing, I guess, up 1. So that's positive. But the NDP down 2. And this seems to be consistent. They're not resonating with dental care, pharma care. And we had NDP leader on Jagmeet Singh last week and such. And he was talking about grocery store issues and such. Oddly enough, he voted with the Conservatives the other day on the televised meeting with the premiers. Where are they in all of this? Because nothing seems to be resonating. They seem to be taking the heat too.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to distinguish yourself from the Liberals when you are the reason they're staying in power, right? And you've got this agreement with them. And yes, you know, a lot of the things that they've been able to get out of the government, like the dental care program, like, you know, the I'm not going to call it a national pharmacare because there's only a few drugs covered, but those things are generally popular. The problem is they don't have a real reason for voters who don't like Mr. Trudeau to really take a look at them yet. I think they're trying to. Even today, Mr. Singh was talking about how he may not be on board with the consumer carbon price and the consumer.
Yeah.
Price.
Yes. So yeah. Interesting.
They're trying to find a way to differentiate themselves, and I think they need to do that, right? Because there are a lot of voters out there who may not ultimately be comfortable with Mr. Poilievre, but still want some change. Mr. Singh's an option for them, but right now they haven't really picked up any of that support that the Liberals have lost.
Only got a few seconds left. David, do you think that post-budget, this either sticks or it doesn't, and he's in or out? Or do you think that will have any or will be a factor in any way?
I have no idea what the Prime Minister's thinking, but you've got to feel that like this is their attempt to try to move the numbers. And if at the end of June, nothing changes, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of Liberal MPs wondering, okay, well, maybe the real problem is the guy at the top.
David Coletto with us, CEO of Abacus Data. New Abacus Data showing the Conservatives in the strongest lead yet. David, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
The Ford government has unveiled a new omnibus bill focused on streamlining home building and approvals in the process. The new Cutting Red Tape to Build More Homes Housing Act includes a reduction in the amount of parking developers need to build, special rules to fast track the construction of student accommodation, and a long-awaited use it or lose it policy. To talk more about this package that just came out today, Murtaza Haider with us, professor of data science, real estate management at Toronto Metropolitan University, and here now. Murtaza, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thank you.
So, Murtaza, your thoughts on this bill that has been released today by the provincial government?
So, just to be sure, it's the bill about the lose it, use it or lose it, or and the similar initiatives that came out, right?
Yes, all under the omnibus bill, the Cutting Red Tape to Build More Housing Act, and I believe that is part of it as well. What are your thoughts?
Sure. So I think the main thing that we particularly like is the new initiatives around parking. And there's one initiative that said that if you are building a multi-family residential building near a subway station or public transit, there may be room for now having you don't have to comply with the minimum parking requirement. So the builders can provide less parking, and thus in doing so can save costs in construction, which they will be able to pass some of those on to the end users. Interestingly, we spent the last 3 years working on a detailed report with CMHC on the very same topic. We have been researching, and we have just released a report, about 150-page long report on the parking minimum parking regulations in three cities, Toronto, Edmonton in Alberta, and Montreal in Quebec. And our findings are exactly the same. So we believe in the efficacy of it. There are not only cost implications of not having to adhere to those minimum parking requirements, so therefore improving, reducing the cost of construction, and as a result, improving affordability of homeowners who will buy those properties or condominiums. But also, these minimum parking requirements have huge environmental and other implications because you remove a lot of earth when you go deep and build underground parking garages. And then over the lifetime, the maintenance of these parking structures also impose additional costs. So for us, we are least surprised to see this recommendation. And we are, in fact, pleased to see that the government of Ontario is moving. And we have to be honest in recognizing that places like City of Toronto have already, the municipal authorities there have already made movement in those directions. And in some cities, they have moved away from minimum parking requirements to maximum parking requirements, so that they remove this expensive necessity that they impose on builders to provide parking. So we for sure are very pleased with this directive.
What about the use it or lose it policy?
So this is amazing. Like this is also something very interesting. So the builders and the development industry have been accusing the municipal authorities of red tape, and they say it would take, for example, 900 days to get approvals in certain places to get a approval, municipal approval. And we are actually, again, studying this as part of we have a research team right now studying this for the City of Toronto. But then again, the cities and the municipal authorities turn around and they say that even when they grant permits to build, sometimes the builders would sit on the permits and do not move, primarily because the market conditions are not right. So now this law says, once you get the approvals, once you get the building permits, now act on it and start building. And if you don't build within a reasonable amount of time, then you will lose that privilege and you will go back to square one. And in certain circumstances, that may not be very helpful. For example, during COVID-19, supply chains were severely disrupted.
Yeah.
Right? So it was beyond the control of builders to execute or start projects. And at times, for instance, when you don't have qualified, certified workers, you don't have certified plumbers and electricians, it's beyond their ability to start or finish or complete projects. So therefore, it has to be a collaboration between the province, the not-for-profit sector that regulates these professions, so that we have a reasonable supply of skilled workers needed for real, for building. And at the same time, we have a reasonable supply, undisrupted supply chains, so that builders can have the materials at reasonable costs so that they can continue with building. So this is, again, for someone who just got a permit and said, okay, it doesn't matter, I'm not going to build, it's not the right time for me, I'm busy building other things, it would push them to start building. So it's a good thing. But at the same time, sometimes conditions are beyond the control of builders.
NDP and the Liberals against this. Bonnie Crombie saying this, these are small ball measures. Merritt Stiles saying it's weak. Should something else be done? Is there anything more they can do?
I was surprised to see the NDP criticism. I think probably they haven't looked at their own record when the NDP was running in Ontario. But I encourage our colleagues in the NDP to go back and see what happened to rental construction in particular and new housing construction in general when they were in power in Ontario. I can tell you right now, the rental construction came down almost to zero in that time period when they were running the show. So whatever tricks they had, they'd never use them when they were in power. And again, yes, are these sufficient or large enough or bold enough? No, there's always room to do more. But I've seen that the people in opposition are more enthusiastic about bold measures, and that enthusiasm fizzles away when they are in power. Then they realize there are regulations, rules, and you have to get things approved. I think we are all moving in the right direction, and the right direction is to expedite construction of residential buildings, especially multifamily residential, and also single-family detached homes, because at the end of the day, you will realize that we will build a lot more of these apartment or condominium-style buildings. And then the young families that are looking for low-rise housing so that they can raise families, they wouldn't see much more options. And you will see a continuous rise in housing prices for low-rise housing for a lack of supply. For instance, Toronto, the city of Toronto, not the larger region, an overwhelming majority of new construction is just high-rise buildings.
Yeah.
And that does not really cater to the needs of young families. And you know, the millennials are now starting to have babies. So between now, that is 2024 and 2030 and beyond, millennials would have tons of babies, and they'll be looking for these baby-friendly housing options, and that's not on the cards anywhere right now. So if you have what's missing,
I got to cut you off there, Murtaza. Murtaza Haider, professor, data science, real estate management, Toronto Metropolitan University, on the Ford government's new omnibus bill, focusing on streamlining the house building process. We've talked an awful lot about affordable housing. What is affordable housing? I'll tell you what affordable housing is. It's something you can afford. How do you do that when there's a shortage? It's supply and demand. At the end of the day, nothing is going to be affordable until we have enough of it. And whether that's building tiny homes or even in your backyard properties, what's that all about? Affordable housing in your backyard. Local nonprofit group In My Backyard can help. They're building their pilot tiny home at a North End property. To talk more about all of this, Siobhan Koch is with us as well. Alicia Wilson, co-founders of In My Backyard. They are here now. Thank you so much for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you so much for having us. We're so glad to be here.
I'm just going to throw the questions out, ladies, and you can answer them any way that you see fit. So, first of all, let's start with In My Backyard. What is this? How did it start?
Mm-hmm. So In My Backyard, or we call ourselves IMBY, is a charity organization. We are half of our co-founder team. There's four of us in total. And all of us came from different backgrounds, from working in social enterprises to building, working for nonprofits. And to be honest, we came about around a campfire dreaming about something different. And my husband and I had experience of living in a tiny home shipping container during a renovation. And we realized, you know, we don't need as much space as we think we need. And Alicia, who will share a little bit about her story, came from working in community housing and group home situations. And one of our other co-founders worked for the Salvation Army for a long time. So with those backgrounds, we dreamed about how can we address the affordable housing crisis in a way that doesn't have to purchase new land, encourages people to live in community. And so, you know, along with dealing with the housing crisis, also really leaning into how do we address the loneliness epidemic, and both of those together was how IMBY was born.
What is the biggest challenge in getting this done, in actually moving this forward? Because it sounds like a great idea, but we hear lots about red tape, lots about construction, all of that sort of thing. What's the biggest challenge to moving these projects or this project forward?
I'll let Alicia, do you want to start that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely the length of time that it takes to get from just the design and permitting to actually building. And we've just recognized that that's a long process, which kind of slows down actually getting homes built that people can then move into. And we're hoping to try to tackle some of those problems with using some modular builds that slow down that speed up the building process. But yeah, definitely the permitting process can be a bit slow and slows down the process.
So say I'm a homeowner and I've got a large lot and I'm thinking this might be a great idea, back corner of the lot, everybody's got lots of space, blah, blah, blah. How long does it take from, as you said, meeting around the campfire to actually getting a home built?
Yes. So our first build definitely took longer than we anticipate the future builds to take. Part of that was when we first were submitting permits, Hamilton had just approved additional dwelling units. And so there was a much steeper learning curve in terms of pieces of the puzzle that needed to get put together. So this build took us about a year, and that was with, you know, not every day working, working through the permitting process, also working through fundraising and donations for some of our materials to bring the cost down. In order to offer affordable housing, we really do need to have our builds sitting at around $150,000 and no more, depending if it's a one person unit. So that is a big part too, is you know, getting all the materials at cost or at a donation so that we could fit within that building.
So who would pay for the structure? Who would pay for the construction?
Yeah. So in our model, or the initial models that we're starting with, our homeowners are paying for the construction. Mm-hmm. Where IMBY comes in is we support homeowners in getting materials at cost or getting materials donated and bringing in volunteer labor to bring down the cost of that unit. So right now our build cost is about 40 to 50% less than a traditional build cost. And because that cost is lower, our host families are then able to offer rent at an affordable price. The other piece that we bring in is we have community partners that we have worked with to try and find our dwellers, is what we call them, those who will live in the tiny homes. And so we recognize not everyone wants to live in like this. And so finding the appropriate people that are a good fit, that are excited to live in community in this type of housing is really important to us. Our goal at IMBY is to not necessarily take those who are already living on the streets and rehabilitate them into someone's backyard, but actually our goal is what we call preventative care. And so how do we take those who are most vulnerable to becoming homeless, those who might be precariously housed, and keep them from becoming homeless? Because we know that the cost of homelessness is exponential the longer somebody lives on the streets. And how do we sit at the top?
How much input would the homeowner have in any of this process, whether it's the build or even those that go in?
Yeah, so they have full input into that. When they partner with IMBY, it really is a partnership. And we work with all of our upcoming builds, we've kind of said to them, we found most of our backyards, they have had something, a person or a type of people that they're really passionate about. And so this mm-hmm. first build, we knew going in, they were really passionate about housing someone who had come to Canada as a refugee. And so then we partnered with organizations that works with refugees to find the appropriate person. In terms of the build, same thing. We partnered with them the whole way through to make sure that it's something that, you know, they were happy with in their backyard, that they enjoyed in their backyard. The build process, like they were involved in all of those pieces. So it's a full partnership with those who are supplying their backyards.
Siobhan Coach and Alicia Wilson, co-founders of In My Backyard, a solution to housing and building tiny homes in one's backyard. Great idea. Siobhan and Alicia, good luck with this moving forward.
Thank you so much.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now.
What was your reaction today when you heard that O.J. Simpson died?
I was surprised. I was going to ask you that. I was surprised because I remember hearing vaguely a while ago that he had had cancer, but I thought he had beaten that. I don't know how to feel because, a murderer has passed away. Oh, well. On the other hand, what I'm noticing is more than the case or even the horrific murder or even him, it's more about where you were when this whole spectacle happened, when the decision came down, the Bronco chase, all of that. And I remember being in the Y95 newsroom, the CHML newsroom, when this decision came down in 1995. My goodness, it was like almost 30 years ago. And it was jammed with people from all over the building coming in to watch. And CNN had a split screen with an audience that was predominantly white and an audience on the other side that was predominantly black. And as the decision came down, half of the audience screamed and the other half were stunned in amazement. I'll never forget that.
I just think it's quite a remarkable coincidence that the same day that O.J. Simpson died, his wife's killer died, which is just, it's hard to.
You have taken my last word pretty much. Yeah, go ahead.
I'll tell you where I can remember where I was, and many people can. This is sort of our generation's Kennedy moment, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But my wife was having a bridal shower for a friend of hers, and our TV was in the basement. And the only way to get to the basement for me, I went up, grabbed some soup or something, and I had to go through the living room where the bridal shower was to make my way down there. And
did you have to wear the hat with the bows on it?
I did not. But as I'm going down, one of the girls who was there whispers to me, let us know. Tell me if anything happens with OJ. And so I'm down there probably for like, I think I was watching the NBA final game. I think it was the Rockets and the Knicks were playing that night in the NBA final. And all of a sudden they break in.
How do you remember that?
I just because it helps. It helps that ESPN did a 30 for 30 documentary night. Anyway,
okay.
So all of a sudden they break in with the Bronco chase, and I then very quietly, because I don't want to be like ruining everything, I just sort of creep up the stairs and I whisper to the girl who had asked me. I said, "They're chasing him down the highway." And she goes, "They're chasing him down the highway." The entire wedding shower. Bride presents, bows on the hat, everything, food, all picked up and moved down in front of the TV set. And they spent the rest of the bridal shower watching OJ and the OJ chase. It was hilarious.
So I guess we know if we talk to the bride, what she'll be speaking of and what she remembers about all this.
It was, I am pretty sure, as I say, and you just mentioned it, that every generation has one or two or three things that are those where were you moments where everybody, I don't know, Scott, was there a person alive who didn't watch some part of the OJ chase? You may have been out, but then you came home and saw it. Like, it went on for four or five hours.
Yeah, and it was, and even the case was televised. So people would just sit and watch that for days, weeks.
Yes, it was a remarkable thing. We're going to be talking about it in my show a lot about that really went a long way to building this idea of televising trials for better or for worse in the States. We still
do. Or car chases.
Well, car chases too, but we don't do it. But you know, there are arguments to be made that there are things that have been bettered by having cameras in courtrooms. And there's arguments to be made that things have been made worse by having cameras in courtrooms. But certainly, I mean, the OJ trial, it became the soap opera. I mean, forget Young and the Restless or Days of Our Lives. Yeah. It was a, so people would gather for, I was working in Brantford at the time at the newspaper there and did a story at one point about someone who would record the whole thing on VHS tapes. They would record the morning, come home, switch tapes, put in a new one and record the afternoon and then stay up and watch it. And they had the whole thing basically recorded. And that's what
you got the box set.
Yeah, the box set. You'd need a forklift and a skid to be able to carry all those tapes now if you had them all. But it was a remarkable thing. I'll tell you one other thing that a number of years ago, we were some friends of ours and my wife and I went down to California and we were driving around looking at a bunch of different famous places and TV houses and everything.
I know where you're going.
No. And we didn't. But the thought was, do we drive by the Bundy Nicole Simpson home where this happened? Bundy Drive, Bundy Avenue, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it was raised, and then someone else, I think it wasn't me, I don't, you know, because of course I would have, but someone said, that's kind of ghoulish, isn't it? And it was like, yeah, it really, when you stop and think about it, I know people still go by, but it is pretty horrendous to think that where a woman was slaughtered has become a tourist attraction. But that's, you know, that's what happens as a result of a story like this.
And someone else lives there.
Yeah, that's... I know they've changed the place. I did look on Google Maps and it doesn't look anything like what it did at the time. And O.J. Simpson's house was knocked down and has now been rebuilt and it doesn't look anything like it. But you imagine though, and we got to go, I know, but if O.J. Simpson's house had not been knocked down and you had gone past the few years or decade of people being disgusted, that thing today would be worth a fortune, partially because it was apparently a beautiful house, but partially because of the infamy. There would be someone willing to pay top dollar for it because it was OJ's house.
All right. Scott Radley continues the discussion after the 6 o'clock news. Read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from Melissa on the topic of the day. Many have debated 30 years ago whether the verdict in the O.J. Simpson case was the correct decision. One tale may be the other or real murderer has never been found. Keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.